Welcome to the official companion podcast to the brand new release movie, Stolen Girl. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to part one of the Stolen Girl official companion podcast, Finding Nadia. Stolen Girl is out in cinemas across South Africa right now, and the film is based on such a compelling and heart-rending real-life case that Filmfinity thought it was a brilliant opportunity to explore it further with all of True Crime South Africa's listeners. This two-part companion podcast series is not just going to be a deep dive into the real case behind Stolen Girl, but Filmfinity also envisioned using the platform to explore the scourge of missing children in South Africa, and the second part of the companion podcast will focus on just that. Why are children going missing in our country? And how can we all contribute to making the world a safer place for all children? Of course, I love the idea of using this platform for any form of education. And if it's around child safety, all the better. But I also loved the idea of this companion podcast for another reason. It's the first time I'll be covering an international case on the podcast. Cue collective gasp from True Crime South Africa's audience. It is a first for the podcast. But even though this case took place in a different country, well, several different countries actually, I still think it's relevant to South Africa. And not just because our moviegoers are about to be enthralled by a stolen girl on the big screen. As the world gets smaller and smaller, and we get more connected across digital borders, more and more South Africans are falling in love with people living outside the country. And not to be an anti-Cupid here, but relationships aren't always smooth sailing. And when you've got two partners of different nationalities, and then add children into the mix, there is always a possibility that one partner will want to go back to their own home country if there's a breakup. While that should be negotiated legally and amicably, that's not always the case, right? Certainly any parent's nightmare is having their child held somewhere out of their reach, and parental abduction in custody dispute cases is not nearly as uncommon as you might think. Add in several international borders between you and your child, and you've got a recipe for a nightmare. And it's this very nightmare that one mother, Maureen Daba, woke up to in 1993. Before I get into the facts of Maureen's case, let's chat about Stolen Girl the movie. Based on extraordinary real-life events, Stolen Girl follows a determined mother, played by Kate Beckinsale, whose world is shattered when her ex-husband, Kareem, abducts their young daughter, Amina, and flees to the Middle East. Desperate to bring her child home, Maureen teams up with Robson, played by Scott Eastwood, an enigmatic ex-Marine and child abduction specialist. Their mission takes them to Beirut, where they dive into a treacherous web of international espionage, betrayal, and corruption. As time runs out, Maureen faces the hardest choice of her life, reclaiming her daughter or leaving her behind for her own safety. Now, like any movie or series based on real-life events, it is not possible to portray the exact events on screen as they happened in real life. Firstly, there's a time limit. Yay for companion podcasts. But also, sometimes pieces of the real-life story just don't translate into something that's essentially viewed for entertainment. As you'll hear, Stolen Girl does very closely mirror the real Maureen Daba's experience. And honestly, even if it wasn't based on a true story, it is really well-written and brilliantly portrayed. I am, however, a true sucker for a based-on-real-life events movie. There's just something about real-life meeting cinematic portrayal that pulls me right in. And I'm pretty sure it's going to do the same for you. Right. So, it's time to get into the case now, isn't it? My research for this episode came from several articles, court documents, and books published over the years about the Dabbaugh's case, as well as academic and legal literature about international child abduction. This is episode one of the Stolen Girl Official Companion Podcast, Finding Nadia. Maureen Dabbaugh grew up in the pine forest country of Florida. Her father was a member of the Cherokee Nation of Indigenous People of that area. So Maureen's upbringing in the 1960s and 70s was slightly different to most other children around her. Her family deeply embraced all its cultural backgrounds, and as a result, Maureen grew up easily interacting with people of all races and nationalities. Her father's job as a preacher also entrenched in Maureen a deep empathy for all human beings and a desire to help. And this would be reflected in one of her first career paths as a paramedic. When Maureen married her first husband and they started a family, which would eventually consist of two children, working as a paramedic became too strenuous when combined with motherhood, so she shifted into working as a seamstress. Her deep desire to effect real change in the world continued to burn in her heart, though. And much later in her life, it would come to the fore again, for reasons she could never have imagined, as she lived a relatively idyllic life with her young family. By the time Maureen turned 32, her life was very different. She was navigating a split with her husband and had been diagnosed with a debilitating rare nerve disease, which had resulted in serious paralysis in many parts of Maureen's body. Although up until that point she'd been splitting custody of her two children with her husband, when this serious condition hit her, she had to make the difficult decision to hand them over to him full time. Maureen simply did not have the physical capacity to care for her children at that time, and she had to be hospitalized for extended periods of time for treatment. The decision was understandably devastating, but she still had a relatively good relationship with her ex-husband, and he ensured that the children got to see Maureen as much as possible while she was receiving treatment. It would be while Maureen was hospitalized during this time that she would meet the man who would change her entire future trajectory. Hisham Dabbaugh was born in Syria and had trained and qualified as a medical technician and worked in several different hospitals across the world. In 1989, when Maureen was receiving in-hospital treatment for her nerve disease, Hisham happened to be working at the hospital in Florida that she was checked into. Maureen would later say that, in retrospect, it made sense to her that she'd fallen in love with Hisham so quickly and deeply. She was still recovering from her divorce, and in a deeply vulnerable position of being very ill and partially paralyzed. For Hisham's part, it's difficult to say whether he actually saw an opportunity for love with Maureen, or if his intentions were always on the darker side. Marriage to a US citizen, of course, would eventually help him to get his own green card in the United States. That would make living and working there far easier. Although the difference in culture between the pair, Hisham, a Muslim man, and Maureen, a very Western woman, should have been a challenge. At least, initially, it didn't seem to be. The treatment Maureen was receiving was working well, and soon she was in recovery and able to leave the hospital and go home. Her and Hisham's relationship continued, and soon Maureen discovered she was pregnant. The couple decided to get married, and on the 3rd of February 1990, their little girl, Nadia, was born. Even before the birth, Maureen had started to notice cracks forming in her relationship with Hisham. She had perhaps not truly realised how traditional he was in many respects, and this pushed up against her own values as a woman who hadn't grown up in a similar background. With their child being a daughter, Maureen began to realise just how much her daughter's upbringing would be impacted by her father's values, which, although she didn't expect him to cast aside, she'd never imagined raising a daughter in. Hisham had also started to show some deeply disturbing behaviour. Their disagreements were never just ordinary arguments, and he seemed deeply intent on controlling Maureen's every move. By the time Nadia celebrated her first birthday, the marriage was already on the rocks. But Hisham was not happy to settle for an easy divorce. The main sticking point in the separation became custody arrangements with their daughter. The couple had moved to Ohio after their marriage, but after the divorce, Hisham had moved back to Florida. And with a 16-hour road trip between the two states, he was pushing for longer periods of custody with Nadia. It was during this time that a real fear began to develop for Maureen. Hisham had told her in no uncertain terms that if he did not get the custody arrangements he wanted, he would make sure she never saw her child again. Finally, an Ohio court granted Maureen a divorce with a custody arrangement of 30 days alternating with each parent. Of course, this would have to be reviewed once Nadia started school, but for the time being, Maureen was just grateful to have the divorce finalised. She was, however, really dreading having to be separated from her daughter for a month at a time. And as the first court-ordered visit crept closer, the knot in her gut got worse. She really did not have a good feeling about this. Nadia's first visit with her father was due to begin on the 3rd of November 1992, and as Maureen hugged and kissed her little girl goodbye, she could have no idea that this would be a moment that would change both their lives forever. Nadia spent the next few weeks in Florida with her father at his house in West Palm Beach. The custody order granted Maureen regular phone calls with her daughter while she was in her father's custody, but Hisham did his best to either completely avoid these calls or cut them short. Nadia was just 2.5 years old at the time, and 30 days is a long time to spend away from the person who's been your main caregiver for all of your life. When contact with her daughter was so sporadic, Maureen's inner alarms were already going off. She did her best to remain calm for her daughter's sake, but couldn't help but wonder if Hisham was going to make good on his threat to make sure she never saw her daughter again. By the time the date arrived that Nadia was supposed to be returned in early December, Hisham was no longer taking Maureen's calls. She was immediately beside herself, but she figured that there was a court order in place. Surely that meant she would be backed up by law enforcement and the courts in getting her daughter returned to her. Maureen was about to discover that, although that was true to a certain extent, the slow-turning wheel of the law was not going to turn any faster, just because she was a terrified mother. Certainly back in the 90s, and even now across the world, parental abduction cases are some of the most difficult to get action taken on, even if you have a valid court order in place. Once law enforcement hears that the child is with their parent, and there's no history of abuse toward the child from that parent, it actually takes quite a lot to get them to take action. And this is exactly what Maureen discovered when she got hold of Florida police and explained her situation. After finally making contact with Hisham and confirming that Nadia was safe and well, they reported back to Maureen that he was going to be making an appeal to the court for a change of custody, and she would be hearing from his attorney shortly. Fine, she thought, but the existing court order says Nadia should be with her mother. Why could police not bring her home in the meantime? Florida police didn't really have a good answer for that. It was also heading into the festive season, and all official systems were slowing down. Maureen was in a complete state. She struggled to work, couldn't eat, and barely had the energy to do anything but make call after call to courts and police officers, begging for help. Finally, on Christmas Day, her telephone rang. It was Nadia on the phone. Maureen crumpled to the floor as she heard her daughter's voice, begging to see her. Then the phone seemed to be snatched away from the child and the line went dead. It was the last time that Maureen would hear her daughter's voice for a very long time. As the courts reopened in January 1993, Maureen made her own petition for full custody of her daughter. Hisham, she argued, had badly violated the existing order and continued to do so, and as such, he could not be trusted to share custody. Hisham was served with paperwork related to Maureen's case against him, and a further month of delay tactics ensued from him. He claimed he couldn't travel to Ohio to appear in court, and Maureen should file her petition in Florida. She refused, and the Ohio court ordered that he should appear in their state. He continued to refuse. This went on throughout the entire month of January. Still, Maureen struggled to have proper communication with her daughter. Hisham made phone calls almost impossible, and Maureen was terrified that he might flee with Nadia if she pushed too hard. As January turned into February, Maureen was becoming increasingly desperate. Authorities in both Ohio and Florida refused to intervene until the new court hearing happened, and Hisham kept delaying it. Nadia's third birthday came and went in early February, without Maureen even being able to wish her daughter a happy birthday. She would often call Hisham's apartment, and sometimes he would answer and put the phone down in her ear, and other times he just wouldn't answer at all. When she heard his voice on the other side, at least, she thought, she knew he was still there. And by extension, so was Nadia. Then, 2 weeks after Nadia's birthday, the phone in his apartment had not been answered in many days. Maureen called the apartment block manager, and he said he hadn't seen Hisham in a while, and he also hadn't paid his rent for February. Then she phoned the hospital where Hisham worked. He hadn't been to work in a week. On the edge of hysteria, Maureen phoned the sheriff's office in Florida. They could not find Hisham or Nadia either. Then, on the 17th of February, his car was found abandoned in an airport parking lot. A ticket on the window showed it had been there for 5 days. Hisham had very likely left the country with Nadia, and he had a huge head start. Despite Maureen's warnings to law enforcement that her husband was a Syrian citizen and he had threatened to ensure she would never see her child again, he had been left to his own devices pending a new custody hearing, even though he was already in violation of the existing court order. His passport had not been confiscated, and although Nadia had not had a passport, he'd clearly had one made for her without Maureen's knowledge. Police were finally able to establish that he had fled the United States on the 12th of February and entered Syria. Although deeply wounded by the system that was supposed to protect her child, it was to the same system that Maureen Dabba now first turned when she knew for sure that the worst had happened. She figured that if she was able to secure a full custody order for Nadia in the US, surely then Hisham's act of holding the child, a US citizen, would be a crime, and the Syrian authorities would work with the United States to bring her home safely. Certainly, this sounds logical. But Maureen would soon learn that there were several countries in the world who would not see it this way, and Syria was one of them. After months of court hearings, Maureen did get full custody of Nadia granted to her, and she was able to get a warrant of arrest issued for Hisham for international parental child abduction. Through connections she was quickly making in the murky world of international child abduction, Maureen submitted these documents to the Syrian authorities, certain that Hisham would be arrested and Nadia would be returned to her shortly. But the Syrian authorities were unmoved. An American court order had nothing to do with them, they said. And there was no extradition treaty with the US either. And even if there was, Hisham was the criminal, not Nadia. So they certainly would not be dispatching one of their citizens back to the US based on the arrest warrant. If Hisham left Syria and tried to re-enter the United States, they could do what they wanted. But until that happened, and Maureen knew it wouldn't, Syrian authorities were not getting involved. Essentially, they did not recognize Maureen's legal custody of Nadia in Syria. She was Hisham's biological daughter, and that was all they needed to know. Maureen was understandably devastated. But even just to get to that point, she'd started to immerse herself in the world of international child abduction. She hadn't just left it to lawyers to handle, mostly because she couldn't afford lawyers, but also because other parents she'd met in the same situation had warned her from the beginning that they'd had no help from the justice system, especially when their children were in countries that didn't follow US-like Western systems, such as Syria. And so she'd learned along the way that most parents, they called themselves the left behinds, ended up turning to a less than above board option to try to get their children back. The snatchback. Essentially, they would kidnap their own kidnapped child back. For many, it was the only way to recover their children, but it came with extreme risks. It was, of course, illegal, and when you were doing it in countries like Syria that did not mess around when it came to punishing criminals, you were literally risking your life. But Maureen didn't care. She was prepared to die to ensure her daughter was safe. And at that point, the thought of never seeing her daughter again and leaving her to grow up with Hisham in Syria was a fate worse than death, in her opinion. International child abduction is so prevalent, even in the 1990s, that Maureen soon learned there was a whole network of people trained for this very activity. They were called snatchback agents, and each specialized in different countries. Maureen's first experience with one of these snatchback agents was one that stuck in her memory. Rather than one individual, it was a group of alleged ex-CIA and FBI operatives headed up by an ex-lawyer. The whole experience was so surreal, set in the dark basements of an apartment building, men who looked like they could snap your neck with one hand, and a distinct feeling that she did not belong there. That although that particular group didn't end up helping her, the moment stuck in her mind for decades to come. There would be many, many more experiences like this, and many more disappointments with individuals claiming they could help her and then either trying to scam her out of money she didn't have or simply disappearing when it came down to the crunch. By this time, Maureen had gone to the press and done her best to get her and Nadia's story out there. And in not so many words, she made it clear that she was now being forced to try the less savoury route to get her daughter out, because she was getting no help from the justice system. Maureen received a lot of support, but many urged her to try to keep things on the right side of the legal line. With her financial situation dire and having been let down by so many snatchback agents, Maureen made a bold decision. She would become a snatchback agent herself. She has never spoken publicly in full about the entire regime of training she undertook to become an agent. The whole industry, if you will, is shrouded in mystery and intrigue, and she'll only say that she became an expert in many areas of clandestine activity, including the lengths one might need to go to extract a child if things turned violent. The following is a direct quote from a newspaper article about her mission to retrieve her daughter from Syria. Quote, Maureen learned how to slip across borders undetected. She learned to make it appear as though she were in several places at once. She trained to use knives, automatic weapons, and improvised devices. She learned how to mine data from computers, plant misinformation, send classified transmissions. She became acquainted with night vision goggles, taser devices, and GPS tracking technology. End quote. While she searched for her own child, Maureen helped to retrieve several others from countries around the world. She watched left behinds like her be reunited with their long-lost offspring. And still, there was no resolution for her and Nadia. Maureen had people in Syria trying to track Hisham down, but he seemed to be living under the radar. It began to dawn on Maureen that in her case, perhaps even being a snatchback agent herself wouldn't help if she couldn't even find her daughter in the first place. And so, in 1996, she decided to throw herself at the mercy of the Syrian authorities. This mother, who had no legal background and who had taught herself international law and trained as a covert agent, now attempted a new route, one which no other American left-behind parent had ever successfully achieved. She applied for legal custody of Nadia in a Syrian court. As a non-Syrian citizen and a woman, she had almost no chance of getting this granted. But incredibly, Maureen achieved it. And in 1996, a Syrian court handed down a custody order for her as Nadia's biological mother. She now had a legal right to have access to her daughter, and withholding that access would be considered a criminal offence. Over the months following this order being granted, Maureen travelled to Syria twice. The first time, she'd been able to figure out where Nadia was living, but couldn't secure the correct paperwork to ensure that she could travel back with her, and despite the court order, police were reluctant to assist in facilitating a visitation. The second time she travelled there, all her paperwork was in order, but Hisham and Nadia no longer lived at the same address. Likely having got wind of his ex-wife's activities, he had fled once again, and Maureen was back to square one. The Syrian authorities told Maureen to go home. They assured her that they would continue to search for Hisham, and as soon as they located him and Nadia, they would inform her and she could come back over and take custody of her daughter. Maureen, however, was not entirely reassured. She knew well enough by now that she could count on very few people, and the Syrian police had refused to officially issue an arrest warrant for Hisham. One night in her home in Ohio, Maureen stumbled across an important piece of information in a case study of another Syrian parental abduction case. Under Syrian law, parents had to register their children as their biological offspring. If the child was born in the country, this would happen automatically at birth. But if they were not, it was the parents' legal responsibility to ensure that this was done as soon as they entered Syria. She wondered whether Hisham had registered Nadia as his daughter. It turned out that he had not done so. Likely another way to avoid being tracked by Maureen. But now, this became her trump card. With Hisham having committed an actual crime in Syria, or at least one they were willing to recognize, a warrant was issued for his arrest. As had become a pattern with Hisham, though, the man once again dodged authorities, and soon both he and Nadia had left Syria entirely. Maureen was horrified. She'd just managed to get this country's authorities on her side, and now she would have to deal with yet another government. And the kicker was, she didn't even know which country they'd gone to. Maureen strongly suspected, though, that Hisham had gone to Saudi Arabia. He'd spoken of the country as much as he had of Syria when they were married. In fact, she knew that he had family in Saudi Arabia as well. With her agent's skills kicking in, Maureen started to track her ex-husband, but it would turn out to be far easier than she thought. Her first step was to get a list of every medical facility in the kingdom. Hisham needed to work, so she hoped that she could track him down that way. She came up with a story about being a nurse from a hospital in America who was treating a Saudi citizen in her facility, and the man's medical information was written in Arabic, so she needed help from the technician in question. The name she could make out for the technician, she said, was Hisham Daba, and she wondered if she could speak with him. It took just two retellings of this story for her to hit gold. Yes, the receptionist said, she'd found the right hospital, but Mr. Daba had just finished his shift. Could she get him to call her back in the morning, the woman asked. Oh no, Maureen said, that's just fine. I've got everything I need. And she did. She now knew that Hisham was most definitely in Saudi Arabia, and he had to be living within a pretty small radius of the hospital he was working at. The Syrian authorities were pleased to hear that he'd been located, but also wondered how he'd gotten out of the country. His passport was supposed to be flagged, and it had been, but Hisham had used a fake passport to travel, and Nadia, who wasn't even registered as his daughter in Syria, also should not have been able to get a valid passport. So she too had travelled under fraudulent documentation. Throughout this case, something has struck me time and again, and that is how reluctant one country is to deal with another country, even if they are right next door to each other. In this case, Syria said that their hands were tied until Hisham came back across their borders. So Maureen had to set about dealing with Saudi Arabian authorities on her own. Ultimately, she wanted to be able to secure assistance to go into Saudi Arabia and remove her daughter back to the US legally. She didn't just want to alert authorities there to his illegal presence, because then he might flee again and she'd have to start all over. So she went to the consulate and spoke with the primary consul there, asking for a visa to enter the kingdom and the assistance to retrieve her child. Initially, the consul wanted nothing to do with it, but after explaining that Hisham was an international criminal, had illegally entered the kingdom with the child and was working illegally, he said he'd see what he could do. A phone call a few days later was a heart-stopping moment that Maureen thought would never come. Saudi officials had not arrested Hisham, but they had escorted him and Nadia to the airport and arranged that they leave the kingdom. Although Maureen was annoyed at this because Nadia was not a Syrian citizen, so she really could not be deported back there, what they said next tempered that annoyance. They'd alerted Syrian authorities to be waiting for Hisham on his arrival, and he'd been taken into custody. He was under arrest and being detained. Maureen scratched together the last bit of money she had left and got on the next flight to Syria, certain that she would be coming home with her daughter this time. By the time she arrived at the police station, though, she was told that Nadia had been handed over to members of Hisham's family, and she had once again disappeared. It was crazy-making. And Maureen soon started to suspect that Hisham had to have contacts in the Syrian police or somewhere else to continuously shrug off her efforts in this way. When she tried to attend Hisham's court hearing, she was told that her presence there as a Western woman, who was, in their words, harassing a Syrian man in this way, would not benefit her case. And so she was left with no choice but to return to the US, once again empty-handed. Hisham was found guilty of failing to register Nadia as his daughter and made to pay a fine. He made a verbal agreement to allow Maureen visitation with her, but there was no written record of this agreement. And then he was released and once again disappeared into Syria. Over the years that followed, Maureen never gave up. She continued to use every avenue she could to get assistance in recovering her daughter. Once, when Nadia was in her early teens, a US representative visited Hisham in Syria and spoke with him for 10 minutes. Hisham gave the man some information about Nadia, her interests and plans for the future, but the girl herself was not present. Maureen was left with no choice but to continue to hold on to hope that one day she would see her daughter again. Perhaps, she thought, once Nadia turned 18 and was able to leave the country on her own, she would come back to her. But Maureen also had to face the reality that she had no idea who her daughter was anymore, whether she spoke English at all, or if she'd even been told that her mother had been looking for her for all these years. Maureen Dabba became an expert in international parental child abduction cases. She turned her own failed case and deep sense of loss into action for those she could help. Maureen became a certified Virginia Supreme Court juvenile and domestic relations mediator. She received her advanced cross-border mediation training at the University of Miami School of Law, and she's authored 2 books on the subject of parental abduction: Recovery of Internationally Abducted Children and Parental Kidnapping in America. Since she lost her own daughter to parental abduction, Maureen has assisted in more than 1,200 international child abduction cases and has been recognized as an expert by courts across the United States, resulting in case law. She has provided testimony on this issue before both the state and federal Congress, as well as the United Nations Human Rights Commission. She plugged the hole her daughter's absence had left with the happy stories of resolution she was able to get for other parents. And then, in the summer of 2010, Maureen's own personal journey into the black hole, as she puts it, ended. Her daughter, Nadia, then 20 years old, travelled from Syria to the United States to meet the mother she'd been ripped away from 18 years before. Although so much of Maureen and in turn Nadia's story is in the public domain, she understandably kept the details of this reunion to herself. It was one piece of her and Nadia's story she could finally tuck away inside her, just for them. Hisham Dabba has never faced any legal consequences for his actions. Nadia's own feelings about what her father did are likely to be complex and tempered by the fact that he is still her father, and her childhood was just what she knew. Coming to terms with the duplicity of a man who's caused such great harm, while still being the only parent you've ever known, is undoubtedly difficult. Perhaps an impossible task to navigate. There were many complex and impossible moments for Maureen to navigate in her 18-year fight for her daughter, too. And one event which she recalls so eloquently presents somewhat of a Judgment of Solomon moment. Maureen never really spoke much about the time she'd spent as a snatchback agent, or how close she'd come to actually abducting her own daughter back from her father. Not until after she'd been reunited with Nadia, and then she could speak more freely. On one of her trips to Syria in the early days, Maureen had actually managed to find Nadia. Or at least she'd found the townhouse she and Hisham were living in at that time, with several other family members. On that day, Maureen had been on a mission. She was prepared to kill or be killed. She managed to secure a weapon and more than enough ammunition, made sure she wasn't followed, and then staked out the townhouse for several days. She didn't see Nadia in person, but she did see Hisham. She watched him as he walked down the road with two shopping bags filled with groceries, and rage began to bubble up inside her. Her finger etched on the trigger of the gun in her lap. But she had a plan that day, and it involved maximum suffering for Hisham. Her plan had been to knock on the door to the townhouse and force her way in. At gunpoint, she would force the family members to tie each other up, and then she would make Hisham watch as she executed his entire family. She would save the final bullet for him, she said, and then she would take her daughter and leave. The plan had been formed in a red haze of rage for the man who had so deliberately and strategically made her life a living hell. But she recalled, as she sat outside that townhouse and watched Hisham go inside, that she'd forgotten one thing. If Nadia was inside, she would see her mother commit mass murder. Even if she locked her up in a room beforehand, at some point, she would have to carry her past the bodies. And although her weapon had a silencer on it, she wouldn't be able to control the family's screams or how they embedded themselves in her child's psyche. Maureen recalled squeezing her eyes shut then, trying to push out the image of her daughter witnessing her mother's madness. As she did, the tinny voice of an imam echoed through the air as prayer calls came from a nearby mosque. As Maureen opened her eyes and looked at the townhouse, she realized that all of the rage and hatred that had had her so close to mass murder had drained out of her. It was all gone. She did not have her child, but she also no longer had a lust for murderous revenge. This was not about her, she recognized. It was about Nadia and what she needed. Despite having been separated from Nadia for so long, deep inside her, Maureen still knew what her child really needed. Maybe she needed to be who she already was. Not a poster child or a missing child, just a child. A child with friends, a school, a home, and a mother who loved her enough to let her be. Maureen had wiped the tears from her eyes and turned the key in the ignition. Years later, as she recalled the story from the safety of her home in Ohio, she understood that in that moment, she hadn't given up. She'd never given up. but she had done what was right for her child on that day. And although Hisham had won the battle, he had not won the war with his intention to keep Nadia from her forever. When the time had come, Nadia had been the one to say, "This far and no further." This has been part one of the official companion podcast to the brand new release movie Stolen Girl, which is out right now in cinemas across South Africa. Now that you know the details of the harrowing real-life story behind Stolen Girl, I highly recommend you book your tickets to go see the movie. I'll be back with part two, in which I speak with an expert in child abduction investigation and prevention, and talk about all the ways we can keep children safe in South Africa. I'll chat to you soon.